I'm Tom Morello,
host of Maximum Firepower,
a weekly podcast focusing on the music, the moments, and the movements that have shaped my worldview and left an indelible mark on me as an artist and activist.
Come correct with Maximum Firepower.
Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters.
This land was made for you and me.
This is Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
I'm Tom Morello. This is Maximum Firepower. My guest is longtime friend and musical comrade Dave Navarro, Shredders Unite. What's going on, man?
I'm good, Tom. How are you?
I'm well.
I was laughing to myself as I was preparing for this interview because we've known each other for so many years.
Yes.
And I've been in two bands that have pretty much nothing in common except for one thing. Neither band wants to follow Rage Against the Machine. Like, we were all on the side of the stage watching the crowd go like that. We're like, fuck, we got to go on after this.
What are we going to open with? What are we going to... That's funny, man. Well, I'm as a huge fan of your play, let's just start. So where we initially met. Now, the first time that we were in a room together, we did not meet.
No.
And I don't know if I've shared this with you, I snuck into a Jane's rehearsal off of Melrose. This was maybe 87, something
yeah,
like that?
Yeah,
maybe
87. I know the studio you're talking about.
It was that spot there, yeah.
Lillian Way and Hybrid Design. That was
That's right.
That was exactly where it is.
Like, yeah, I lived right up on Normandy. Like, there was a hot tip that Jane's was rehearsing here, and I just like walked into the room and sat down on the floor. Now, there were some other people sitting on the floor who were probably your friends and girlfriends and drug dealers, whoever it was at the time, and I got to watch the band rehearse for about 2 hours, and you played a lot of material that I was unfamiliar with. I think that there was a cachet of songs that maybe later came out on Ritual and stuff that were already in the can there. Yeah. So what are your memories of like that time? Because it's hard to describe to people who weren't in LA the almost religious power of that band that it had over the city and casting the nets, welcoming in this what would later kind of maybe sort of be the Lollapalooza nation, but at the time was this nascent, this tribe that was just discovering who it was, and we had our Santeria shamans.
Yeah, my memories of that time were, you know, it's such a strange time to reflect back on, especially at this age, because, you know, in the age of social media and internet and communication where it's at, like, we didn't have any of that back then.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult to gauge the level of value or impact that we had on the community or the music community the world or on any level, because we couldn't search it. We couldn't,
yes.
You couldn't get feedback from the fan base. Nobody could tweet at you. Like,
yeah.
So it was like, really, my life consisted of, and I must have been about 19 at the time, maybe. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was between home and rehearsal and shows, and that was about it. So I didn't really, you know, and never did we go out into the audience and hang out with people afterwards. Yeah. So, like, I just really didn't know the difference, to be honest.
Yeah, you weren't able to feel. Well, that's fascinating, because it was such a thing. And, you know, I was, you know, part of the... You know, the people that get in there, put their Marshall half stack in their van and move from Illinois to Hollywood to try to figure it out. Like,
yes.
You know, the great gold rush migration of rock and roll. And, you know, and my aspiration was to be like what I thought of. The posters on my wall were like metal bands.
Yes.
You know, they were metal bands. Metal bands. And I wanted to be that. But when I arrived, I found a very, very different scene. I thought maybe I could fit in. My niche might be kind of the Steve Vai, Tony McAlpine, Yngwie Malmsteen niche. Like, I could play my ass off.
Yeah.
But then when I arrived, the scene, it was Jet Boy and Faster Pussycat Guns N' Roses and this kind of cowpunk thing. And everybody just looked so cool and couldn't play at all, but the places were packed. And it was all like, this kind of like grimy sex stuff. And I was just like, I can't do any of that.
I know. I try to describe that time to people, what you're talking about, because even though I didn't move here I certainly know, you know, I definitely was the half stack in the back of the hatchback, yep. and taking it to gigs, playing and saying thank you, good night, and then getting down and like winding cords up myself.
Oh, you're
like, the lights come on and you're just like all the mystery.
The beer soaked cords that you're winding around your arm.
The mystique
there.
Is gone. You know, you're just leaving some little club, a coach house or something. Yeah. But that time, like, I essentially came from the same background as you. I came back from, you know, Perkins and I had a metal band in high school. So Steven and I were playing together since before Jane's Addiction. And we were playing...
Was it cover songs or was it...
Yeah, it was all cover songs. And it was like Scorpions, Metallica, Van Halen. So we came from that scene and were heavily... You know, I loved punk rock and I loved like some of the post... like the post-punk kind of goth stuff that was happening. Yep. But as a shredder guy, I couldn't get past the lack of what I thought was musicianship at the time.
Sure.
Now I see as restraint or alternative thinking or even more creative, you know, a more creative way to say the same thing. At the time, at the age, I was like, there's nobody ripping in here, so.
But thank goodness, because that's part of what I want to talk about is thank goodness that there was that element, because Jane's is one of my favorite bands, and one of the reasons, maybe along with like Soundgarden, maybe along with like Living Color, there were a couple of bands, but Jane's, I put it at the apex of it, is it made heavy metal music okay for smart people and for people who were like, people who were not into like Groupies and the Devil. You know what I mean? With all those songs, I loved all those bands that you're talking about, but I couldn't relate to anything in the Scorpions lyrics other than that they kind of kicked ass, you know, and then there was a lot of like demonic imagery, which I guess that makes parents mad and whatnot. but your band, and particularly your guitar playing, because you were obviously like on first listen to me, it's like that guy is a gunslinger, heavy metal guitar player, but in the context of something completely different and a different, like aiming for something completely different as a band that made, it was a revelation to me. It was like, there's a different way to kick ass at electric guitar where you don't have to have like the tropes of, you know, of the devil and of like the limousine motorcycle groupie thing, and it could be about different stuff, and yet without budging one inch on the heaviness and the kick-ass shredding.
Well, the interesting thing about Jane's and what you're talking about is, I think once I hooked up with Perry and lyrically saw where he was coming from and realized that, oh, being completely honest is way darker than a drawing of the devil. you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, like accessing what's really going on is truly darker than any of the stuff that I came from. And that resonated with me. And Perry and Eric Avery were very respectful and in love with the musicianship that Steven and I brought into the band in terms of, you know, we wanted to rip at all times. And once we got in the band, they harnessed those aspects. You know, we were kids. We were right out of high school.
Yes.
So they kind of harnessed those aspects that they loved and tried to dismiss the ones they didn't love. Yes. While at the same time, Perkins and I were still trying to force things that we loved in. So, for instance, Perry and Eric were not Rush fans, okay?
I would not imagine that they were. I would not imagine.
However, Perkins and I were Rush fans. So when it came to a song like 3 Days or, you know, Then She Did, which are essentially poems of really significant lyrical content, and they were long form and they were 8-9 minutes, well, that's where Perkins and I were like, well, this is like Rush. So like we're great. It was like Hemisphere. Yeah. We're doing Hemispheres. So I think that at that time, though, the juxtaposition of where they were coming from, where we were coming from, is what helped create what you found. And when another thing that kind of kept us away from being attached to any genre is because our friends and the bands that we would play with were nothing like us.
That's correct. Yep.
You know, and it was great. And I think that's where the idea for the first Lollapalooza came together, was because that bill was very, everybody was kind of alternative, but they all had their own niche of it. You know, you had the Body Count, you had Living Color, you know, and Fishbone and Susie.
Yeah,
all these different little areas of the alternative scene kind of put together on the same stage. We were all like, wow, we're all kind of doing the same thing all of a sudden.
That's right. Yeah.
It was music for
Misfits that then became the mainstream part because of that tour. You know, it was really that tour, while there had been, you know, multi-band, more diverse festivals in Europe, that was the first time in the United States where in an amphitheater, 18,000 people or whatever, or 30, however many it was on whatever the day, got to see this real eclectic mix. And it really, I think that Janes as a band musically kind of helped save hard rock music in a way. But that tour forged what became the massive global genre of alternative music, and making it okay under this one banner of weirdness to kind of be whoever you wanted. That's what got Rage Against the Machine like that. When we got, because we came in the wake of that, you know, there was Janes and there was Soundgarden, there was Primus, then there was like the commercial success of Pearl Jam and Nirvana, and that's when I think that the record industry let go of thinking they knew how to make something happen. It was no longer you bring in the A&R guy to dress him up and have the songwriters come in. And this, it's like, we don't understand this, but whatever is really happening is the thing. And that opened the door for Rage, for sure. I'm Tom Morello. This is Maximum Firepower. My guest is the Dave Navarro. So you have had not just a second act, but like a third act in an incredible way for someone who has, you know, sort of gone through the gauntlet of rock and drug addiction and whatnot to become, you know, like a TV, kind of a TV star for like 12 seasons or something like that. Because it's one thing to like be a person who has tattoos. It's one thing to be a person who exists in a world where there's kind of like reality TV show competitions. But how did that not just come about, but how did you get over in such a great way with that show? It's kind of miraculous.
It is. It's hard to believe. And honestly, I don't know, because it was never my intention to be. I never auditioned for anything. I never sought out anything the furthest thing from my mind.
Whereas just so people know, we're talking about the show Ink Master.
That's
which
right.
Which was on for how many years? Years.
Well, 13 seasons. Yeah.
13 seasons where it was a competition of tattoo artists to do tattoo art. Sometimes they would even tattoo Dave, right? If you
exactly
win the contest.
True.
Or
something, exactly
you get
true.
To tattoo Dave. But it was a hugely popular show with Dave.
It came about, and then just someone said, are you interested in, and I, you know, at the time, like, I just was like, well, you're asking me if I want to just go hang out and watch artists excel at what they do and just be inspired by that. That's all it required from me. And that's how I looked at it. It was like, I love art. I love visual arts, cinema, and music, and what any kind of artistic expression. And these guys are basically doing the same thing in a world that I don't live in, except as a client. So I just said, yeah, that sounds like fun. And the thing just kind of caught on, and it was weird. When you notice the difference between being a visible musician versus a visible person on television.
Yes.
Because now I'm hitting the music fans, but I'm also hitting all of their family members. So it actually cranked up my visibility more than I was comfortable with.
Yeah.
Because I enjoyed being able to walk through the airport. I enjoyed, going to a restaurant, and then that was over after that, And so it was kind of a double-edged sword, whereas I loved doing the show, and I loved watching the artwork happen and watching people excel at their craft. I mean, there's nothing more inspiring. And you can draw inspiration from anybody who's just kind of up against it and going under the gauntlet and still coming through. And I got to see that every single day. But at the same time, like, I would have people come up to me on the street and tell me they love the show who had no idea that I was a musician at all.
Yes, yes.
And
yes,
I was like, well, this isn't, I don't do this. This isn't,
yeah, yeah.
This,
is, this, is, a, this is a
this
me.
This is an opportunity.
This yeah, this is a this me. Is a, yes.
But, you know, one of the things that I think is, you know, and I appreciate you bringing it up, but one of the things that I've been kind of grateful for in a bizarre way is that Janes or anything I've done, we've never cracked through and been like this super huge thing that could eventually be you know, fall to the wayside. Like I feel like we've just kind of we've just kept hanging in there. You know what I mean? Yeah. We never went totally away, and we never broke massive, which allowed for some longevity, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So talk for a minute, like, about how has your sobriety impacted your life? Because, you know, when we met, you were not a sober person. And
no.
I know that there's been an ebb and a flow at times.
Yeah.
But talk for a minute about that, because I think that's important for people to just hear.
Well, I mean, I'll tell you that, you know, those early years of drug addiction and, you know, there were good times. I'm not going to lie about that. But for the most part, it was pretty miserable and made for a pretty horrible dynamic within the band. And ultimately, I think, destroyed the band, because you had three people who were trying to invent what's going on in each other's heads. And emotionally responding to it. What I mean? So, like, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, that's when the drugs really start, like, going, I'll bet he's thinking this, so fuck him. And and we're all doing that. So, like, you know, it really just didn't make for anything to be to work. And I will say that for the last couple of years of Jane's, Eric and I were pretty clean by then. So by the time it was like 1990, 1991, we were pretty together. So I was able to go to Lollapalooza, and I was able to stand on the side of the stage from noon on. You know, I mean, I would literally stand there from the first band until it was time to go.
Yeah.
And then just kind of hustle over to the other side and play. I mean, I got to see Nine Inch Nails every day at 3 p.m.
Incredible. Yep.
Broad daylight, you know.
Incredible.
It was just the coolest fucking thing.
Yep.
But, you know, I've obviously long since put that stuff down, and it just, you know, I'm more about connection and doing stuff because I'm inspired and because I love it, rather than having some kind of attachment to an outcome. And I think that, you know, just like all the negativity and all the darkness that kind of lifestyle brings into one's life when they're trying to do something that's essentially from the heart and that's creative, it tends to stifle it and make it so you're not even able to get your own message across, you know. And so I think that and if it does, it's through a pair of goggles that you don't want to really be looking through, you know. You certainly don't want to be looking back through it, you know. But I would say that I have enjoyed and love playing 1,000 times over more since I put all that down, because then I'm really able to tap into, you know, whoever that 11-year-old kid with the guitar at home in his bedroom playing, I'm able to tap back into that a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing that I really loved about it to begin with.
The fact that some people are able, you know, historically, whether it's a Coltrane or a Hendrix, who, you know, their creativity is in some ways wrapped up in being high, was always like so foreign to me. Like, I once, it was an early kind of Rage show, I had a really crappy show, and then I was like, man, like, what was wrong? And I realized that I had had something to drink before the show, and I just thought, well, I don't want a crappy show.
No, I know.
I don't want a crappy show.
Well, I mean, there's also, you know, if you even put it, you know, you put it to artists that were either amazing or terrible.
Yes.
And Hendrix had some pretty terrible shows. I mean,
of course.
Apparently,
of course,
the first night of Band of Gypsies was not good. And then the second night is when the record that we have today that we all love was put together.
Yeah.
And I know that similar thing that you're talking about is that the drugs, you know, again, with the inner dynamics of the band being insanity, and then you throw drugs on top of it, and you throw miscommunication and misdirected anger into the soup, and then throw it out on stage for people to witness publicly, you're going to have some, you know, you're going to have some bad results. But, you know, ultimately, even with all, like, you know, the quote unquote regrets in mind, like, I still wouldn't change any of it, because, you know, whereas I think that a song like 3 Days was still Perry and I tapping into our unconscious, it would not be the song it is had we not spent 24 hours on speed focused on it. You know what I mean?
So
I don't want to sit here and say, like, oh, I wish we never did that. Like, it is what it is. I'm just glad I'm still not doing that.
Exactly. Know? And that you survived it.
And that
you survived it. You know what I mean? That's a key part.
Especially after this year that we've had, I have lost so many people to overdoses and suicides and just, like, the worst trauma that, you know, that I've seen this intensely condensed ever in my life, you know, for people, just for the world, and certainly people that I know. And I'm just so grateful that I was able to deal with those things long before we found ourselves in this world.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, imagine the pressure cooker, yeah, if that was not the case.
I mean, imagine a kid trying to get clean or get it together under, like, you know, the height of the pandemic where everything's locked down. They can't even go to a meeting. They can't, you know, everything's on Zoom and there's no human connection. It had to have been rough, you know, and I'm just really grateful for the fact that I had music and art over the past year rather than, you know, my addiction, because that would have killed me.
Yeah, there's no, it's been so stressful in so many ways. Okay, so I want to just to pivot a little bit. I know you have to leave, so, like, quickly, what's your Mount Rushmore best metal guitar players of all time?
Give me four. David Gilmour, Jimi Hendrix, Eddie Van Halen. I'm going to go ahead and throw Daniel Ash on my Rushmore,
okay,
just because the guitar player of Bauhaus was the missing component in terms of my my influences. He was the missing component in for the Jane's Addiction thing. Cause Gilmour, just introspective and melodic. Halen is groundbreaking and fucking a pioneer of just so much. Hendrix was just so saturated in the blues and just like deep, deep blues background. And then Daniel Ash, who just took the guitar from a whole nother angle and almost kind of made it this angular device.
Yep.
That's what I drew from. What's your Mount Rushmore?
Oh, I mean, it changes. I would probably go Jimmy Page for the riffs and the orchestration. Randy Rhoads for me for the combination of, like, the technique and fire.
Yes.
I would go Jimi Hendrix for reimagining the instrument and sort of bringing out of, like, sort of from a Buddy Holly world into anything's possible world. And then I'm going to go, my outlier would be Andy Gill from Gang of Four, who for me was like the missing component of, like, this kind of outside playing of, you know, like you're not always playing for the song. Sometimes you're playing against the song.
Against it, totally.
You know what I mean? And that just a way of, like, looking at music as a thing that can be, it can be lyrics aside, the music can be confrontational from the point of view of the guitar player. You know what I mean?
It can conflict within itself.
And sometimes that's
a beautiful thing. And when I was in the Chili Peppers, we played lots of Gang of Four shit. So I got a crash course on him, and I had to learn all those parts. And I was like, this guy's coming from a completely different place.
And, you know, and then to try to have, you know, for me, like, having those different arrows in my quiver of both the shreddy, you know, Randy Rhoads stuff and the, you know, one guitar solo might be just a note that's in a different key as the song.
Yeah.
The end. You know,
Randy for me was the guy who made it, like, okay to double a guitar solo.
Sure.
Because I just fucking
or triple
love,
as he did. Yeah.
I love that sound. I just love how he did that.
And absolutely lastly, what happened to the Black Les Paul from the early Jane's days? I love that guitar. Where's that?
I don't know where that is, but I will tell you that, man, when I was there was a
that was
time
a badass when I, that was a badass guitar, dude.
I love that guitar. I'll tell you that I think Perry broke it at a show. He threw it and it cracked. The neck cracked in half. Got it repaired, never was the same, and I think it ended up seeing its way to a pawn shop nearby. I will say that years later, I was playing with Guns N' Roses for like 2 seconds because I was considering hopping on board that train, and I had a Les Paul, and I ended up giving it to John Frusciante when he was in treatment, you know, years before the Peppers. And for me, anyway, and John did what junkies do with guitars, which is, you know, the same thing I did with many of mine. But years later, when he got his life together, he brought a Black Beauty back to me as a gift. So I have the Black Beauty Les Paul 70s era that I had for those early, the one that you're talking about.
Yeah.
It kind of came back to me through John, which is
pretty
amazing.
That's lovely. That's a badass guitar. All right. Well, Dave, thank you very much for your time. And it's always, I look forward to a time when we can sit at the Rainbow and just
talk, I do too, man. Rock and whatnot. Anytime, Tom. Thank you so much, brother.
This has been Maximum Firepower with Tom Morello. Thanks very much, Dave Navarro. Until next time, take it easy, but take it.
Let foes of justice tremble.
This has been Tom Morello's Maximum Firepower.
Hear this episode again
or listen to past shows right now
on the SiriusXM app.
Search Maximum Firepower.